Okay, so I would like to invite Ajahn to give the talk called Beyond Puja, Dharma Talks and Charity.
Very good. So thank you for that nice introduction. And it's very great to be back here in the VGF. I don't know when I was last here, but it was too long ago. So it's very nice to be back here with you all, with many old friends. And you're getting older every year, and so am I. So it's about time we got beyond our pujas and our charities and listen to Dharma talks to get something more interesting in our sort of Buddhist life. Because many of you, hopefully you know just how strong something like Buddhism is growing in Western countries. Just recently I went to give talks all over the place. This was to a Rotary Club close by. And one of the Rotarians there, he was the chaplain of a Christian school over just south of Perth. And he was a bit concerned. He said to me, I asked all my students, he said, if you weren't Christians, what would you be? Buddhists, sir, we'd be Buddhists. He was getting quite concerned. And that is actually pretty much what's happening in the Western world. Because Buddhism is getting very, very popular. But you see, like Westerners, especially people who have had high education, the pujas and chanting, they're not really into that so much. Number one, they haven't got a clue what they're chanting. because I'm a bit sort of a cheeky, Mike, but sometimes I've threatened at the marriage chanting, which we do the funeral chanting instead. Or the other way around. And people wouldn't know what we were doing. They'd think, oh, it's auspicious. They wouldn't know what type of chanting we were doing. But don't worry, Lai Peng. When I did some chanting at your mother and father's house today, that was a proper chanting. It wasn't anything negative. But, so chanting is actually good when you know what it means. And certainly for me as a monk, because this is my life, this is my profession, I've been a monk for such a long time, what it actually means is that when I chant, I know what I'm talking about. When I'm chanting, I know the meaning. And that's why some of the things we chant are very, very profound. It's very beautiful. Dhamma there. And this is like the word of the Buddha. So every time I'm chanting, I'm listening to like a Dhamma discourse. Just like today, the one of the Inner Ratana Sutta. There they give actually, one of the verses there was explaining what Nibbana was. Full enlightenment. Nibbanti Dira Yatayang Padipo, I chanted. That one is going to Nibbana, just like this flame will one day go out. And that was actually a meaning there. They were giving a synonym for Nibbana. So when I chant, I know exactly what it means, and it's very, very profound. But you've got a bit of whistling there. Because now I'm an Australian monk, and Australian monks like to whistle. So it's nothing to do with the speaker. It's just. But anyhow, so the chanting is okay, but we need to go deeper than the chanting. And the charity is a lovely thing to do. We need to have charity just to keep the Buddhist Gem Fellowship going, and especially with their new premises. I don't know the last time I told you about sort of charity and how difficult it is sometimes. Do you remember the story of the suicidal spider? Once, there was a spider, and he was just newly born, and he made a beautiful little web in the corner of somebody's house in PJ. Not saying whose house, but as soon as he, know how much work it takes to build a web, and how intricate, and how this spider put so much love and care into building his web, and as soon as he was finished, the maid got a broom and smashed it to bits. Before the spider had even any time to find any fly to eat for dinner. So his first house was destroyed and he was hungry. And he ran for his life to the house next door and built another web. It took him hours and hours. And as soon as it was finished, he sat in the corner, 5 minutes, all he had. And someone saw it and smashed that to bits with a broom. And a third house, and a fourth house. He built a web. And we all know that 4 is an unlucky number. And that 2 was destroyed. And after 4 houses, the spider gave up. Imagine if you built 4 houses, and each one of them was destroyed by earthquake, tsunami, I don't know what. And you hadn't had anything to eat, and you'd worked so hard. That spider got depressed. In fact, he was so depressed, he decided to end his life. He walked down the street, and when he saw a person walking, he tried to walk under their feet. But he always managed to find the space between the heel and the sole. You know, there's a bit of a space. So then he decided to try and crawl across the road, the highway. But every time he went in the highway, he was always like between the wheels. He could never actually get into a wheel and kill himself. He couldn't even end his life properly. So the spider got double depressed. And he was walking along the road, so sad, so depressed, he was crying. Tears were coming from his eyes and wetting his fangs. Oh, he was the most suicidal spider there's ever been in the whole of Malaysia. And as he was crying and feeling so sorry for himself, he came across a fat spider. Now this spider was so fat and happy, had a big smile on his face. And because, you know, you're happy and you're fat, you're always very kind. So of course. So the fat spider looked at this suicidal spider and said, "Oh, what's wrong with you?" And the suicidal spider told a sad story of his whole life, of web after web destroyed, of never having anything to eat, and no one loves him, no one likes him, and that's why he was a suicidal spider. And the big fat happy spider, out of compassion, said, "Oh, that's such a sad tale. That's so sad. Why don't you come and live with me? Look, you can see there's plenty for everybody where I live." And the suicidal spider looked at that other spider, and he was fat, and he was jolly. And he said, "This is really strange. Wherever I built a web, it was always destroyed." And the fat, jolly spider said, "Oh, not me. I built one web when I was very young, and it's still there. I catch lots of flies and other insects. It's enough to eat for all of us. You come and live with me." He said, "But don't people destroy your web?" "Oh, no. No one's destroyed my web. Where did you build it?" He said, "I built it in the donation blocks of the Buddhist Gem Fellowship. No one ever disturbs me in there." So, please disturb the spiders today. So charity is good, and it's good fun as well when you make nice stories like that. And it also makes you feel good. So we can't demean charity. Charity is very good. And listening to Dharma talks is very good. But if listening to Dharma talks is just teaching you the same old thing, maybe we can do much more than that. And actually there is so much more to get out of Buddhism, which is why Buddhism is just so popular in the Western world. For its philosophy, for its very strong morality, and of course for its wisdom as well. And of course, that wisdom is not something you just read in books, although it is good to read the books. One of the great things of our modern time, in the time of the Buddha, sometimes you would have to walk for days and days and days just to listen to one sermon. Today you don't need to walk. Just get on Google and Google it, Ajahn Brahm or Ajahn Sumedho or Venerable K.C. Dharmananda, and even if he's dead, you've still got lots of sermons out there for him. Isn't it wonderful today? We've got so much access. And even if you want to see what the Buddha actually said, we've got all of the teachings of the Buddha, and they're all translated into modern languages. We are so privileged in our modern realm. So, if you are really interested in taking your Buddhism further, how about reading some of those original teachings of the Buddha? They're not that hard to understand. And they become like eye-opening, actually, to see what people were really like in the time of the Buddha. Because sometimes people tell me, oh, in the time of the Buddha, people, they had so much good qualities. They just listened to one sermon, they get in line because they were special people at that time. No, they weren't. They were just the same as people today. No different. And if you want to find out, one of the places you can read, and it's a fascinating place to read, is in the stories which led up to the rules of Vinaya for the monks and nuns. Because there you get little anecdotes, snapshots of real life in the time of the Buddha. And just as an illustration, I'm going to tell one of those stories. This is the story which led to one of the rules in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, the rules for the fully ordained Buddhist nuns. Because there were Buddhist nuns in that time of the Buddha, and they were living in the town for their safety. And one morning it was the job of one of the nuns to empty the bucket from the toilet. Now in those days we didn't have plumbing and sewage, so all of the you-know-what would be collected in a bucket, and one nun had the job to actually dispose of it. So, early in the morning, she took the bucket, and she must have been a bit lazy, because instead of putting it in the proper place, she decided to throw it over the wall of the monastery. Because you know what happened next. It just happened there was a businessman who was on his way to see the king. Now, when you are on an appointment to see someone, you know, like a prime minister or a sort of a sultan, or in this case the king, you usually wear your very, very best clothes. And you usually have washed your hair. You're just so well groomed. And that was this man, so well groomed with his best clothes on when a bucket of shit fell on his head. And what would you do if that happened? He was so upset. He knew it was a nun's monastery on the other side. He said, what can they do this for? These aren't real nuns. They're just a bunch of wanton women. These aren't real nuns. I'm going to teach them a lesson. Look what they've done to me. And in those days, they used to build all of their huts out of wood. So he got a fire stick, a torch, and he was going into that monastery to burn the whole monastery down for what they did to him on the way to the king. But there was an attendant at the doorway. Now, where's my attendant today? He's over there somewhere. Very good. Now, this is how an attendant should behave. Now, take count of this. And anyone else who wants to be an attendant of a monk or a nun, listen to this. You've got to be smart. Because this guy was coming in to burn down the whole nun's monastery. And this attendant said, what are you doing? Look what these women did to me. They aren't real Buddhist nuns. Look what they did. I'm going to burn down their monastery, teach them a lesson. He said, hold on a minute. You mean that came from a holy nun? Yeah. That's auspicious. must really be lucky, because no one else gets such, you know, intimate, holy stuff, you know, from these great enlightened nuns on the other side of the wall there. Wow, you're so lucky. Now, even in the time of the Buddha, just like today, people are so superstitious and gullible. Sometimes you believe anything, buying all these medals around your neck and other stuff. But he said, really? Is that auspicious? Yeah, it really is auspicious. You're so lucky. Look, he said, put that sort of flame away. Go back home. Get changed. You know, just wash yourself, you know, get the stink out of you, and go back to the palace. Something very lucky is going to happen to you today. I'm sure that's a blessing. That's auspicious. That is so lucky. And he believed it. So he went back home, showered, got changed, and as it happened, the king did give him a big contract. And so he went around saying, oh, if you really want good luck... Especially Chinese New Year, if you want really good luck, we've got two sisters. But when the Buddha heard it, he told the nuns and said, look, you were very lucky that time, just because you had a smart attendant. But, you know, very, very lucky. Next time it's not going to happen. So because of that, one of the 311 rules for bhikkhunis, for nuns, is not to throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. That's one of the 311 rules. Look it up for yourself. Now, what that shows, that's a funny, one of my favourite stories in there. What it actually shows is people in the time of the Buddha were exactly the same as people today. No difference. And when you read stories like that, it means that, look, in the time of the Buddha, that people were doing all this meditation and getting all these great states and getting enlightened and stuff like that. So why not today? So when you read these teachings of the Buddha, you know, just not just, you know, part of it, but just read widely through the teachings of the Buddha, you actually get quite inspired and also educated about what Buddhism really is. So to take Buddhism further, just get into the library. Now, buy some of these books. Over in places like Perth, we have sutta classes. We take some suttas, but not just from the same old place, the same old suttas. A sutta is one of the teachings of the Buddha. Take them from many little places, and I put them all together so you get some understanding of what actually the Buddha taught. And it becomes eye-opening. So find out what Buddhism truly is. And it means you don't have just to believe the monk. You can read it for yourself. Because you know what it is? There may be five monks, and they tell five different things. But that's okay, because sometimes we realize they're not really arguing with each other. It's just looking at things from different angles. That's all it is. And if you actually see what the Buddha actually said, you can understand why one monk says this, why another monk says that, and why they're not really contradicting each other. They're just seeing the same thing from two or three different angles, just like in the time of the Buddha. So you get the full picture. And that's a wonderful thing to have in our modern world, to get the full picture of actually what the Buddha actually taught. And it is quite inspiring, interesting, and also illuminating. Yeah, these people did it. Because in the time of the Buddha, all types of people, they weren't all highly educated. They were street sweepers. They were people who were humpbacks, prostitutes, millionaires, and just down and out. People who were crazy, like Patachara, murderers, like Angulimala. All of these people became enlightened. So when somebody asks me today, can we become enlightened today? I ask them, how many serial killers are there here today? Any serial killers here today?
Put your hand down.
Well, a serial killer like Angulimala became enlightened, so why can't we become enlightened? So what that actually does, it inspires you. So one great thing which we have found to put Buddhism further and to make a bit more understanding, inspiration and growth in our practice and in Buddhism in general, is actually have a look at some of those books. Read them. They're readily available. And if you can't afford them, just get on the internet and download them for free. Because, you know, we're not really concerned about sort of copyright and all this sort of stuff. Because who's got the copyright anyway? The Buddha's got the copyright. So it's all for free anyway. So, that's number one. Now number two also, when you're actually reading, what particular sutras should you read? Should you read the Theravada sutras, or the Vajrayana sutras, or the Mahayana sutras? Which one should you read? Read the whole lot. Because this is what we're doing in our modern world. It's a great time to be alive as a Buddhist. You know, in times before, a Theravada monk would never meet a Vajrayana nun. We'd all be in our own countries, in our own monasteries. We'd never meet each other. Now we've started to meet each other, listen to each other's talks. We're discovering something really quite remarkable. There ain't much difference. In some of the monks, these are mostly Western monks, they're doing this amazing research, especially comparing the Agamas of Mahayana in the Chinese tradition with the Pali Tripitaka, which is, you know, mostly from Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand. Comparing these. Thank you. It's comparing these things. Do you get me? Very good. Comparing these. See, why not? See, we'll just have fun. So, comparing these, when they compare them, you know what they find? No one has got the absolute truth. So there's many things in Theravada Buddhism which are just not what the Buddha taught. Now, it's true. Now, sometimes people say, oh, you can't say that. Why can't I say that? I have said it, so there you go. Number two, there's many things in Mahayana Buddhism which the Buddha never said. Many things in Vajrayana the Buddha never said. But when we combine all the three, we find out what we have in common. And that's very likely what the Buddha said. And that is something which we all share. And so because we're seeing just what we share and how much that is, our differences are just so small. And what we have together is so large. We're discovering that now. For example, just last, we have this arranged retreat. The last retreat we had, this is a monastic retreat from July to October. We had two Mahayana monks from Korea staying in my monastery. This is Mahayana monks staying with Theravada forest monks. We got on so well that there was, what's the difference? They were just one of us, we were one of them. And we could live together just, and there was no separation or boundaries between us at all. They did everything we did, and they were just very happy to do that. And we realized, look, all this difference between Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Zen or whatever, that's just so much on the surface. And so one of the things which we should be doing as Buddhists is not interfaith, but what we call intra-faith dialogue. Between Buddhism, to go to each other's temples, to meet with each other, to talk, to discuss, to study, and we find no difference at all. It's because of that. Because of that, I tried to find some term to actually to connect all of the different types of Buddhism together. Let's stop calling it sort of Theravada or Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Because that's dated. Let's have a term. Francis. Now look, stop taking away my jokes. Just to be heard it before. I'm going to tell it anyway. So, we take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. 8 from Hinayana, aha from Mahayana, and Jnana from Vajrayana, the Hahayana. Because that's another important thing that we should, in our religion, sometimes religious people are far too serious. And it's something like, almost like a diviner, a spiritual, an enlightened sense of happiness as well. Because you know, once when you start laughing, you can never get upset or angry. Laughter is an antidote to ill will. Even if you have a good laugh, and then so the person sitting next to you, you know, who didn't brush their teeth today, so they stink a bit, you don't matter so much. You don't get so upset. Because that laughter and the happiness is something which binds us all together. Or, as a Tibetan Buddhist monk once said, he said, when he gets people laughing, that's the only time when their mouth is open so he can put in the pill of wisdom. But it's true, because you're listening when you're laughing. So, try and not just be... One of the nice things about the BGF, one of the things I love coming here, because you're not really Theravada, Vajrayana, Mahayana, you're just Hahayana, Buddhist, whatever. But, you know, this is modern Buddhism. We try to take away those barriers which separate us so that we can be friends. Now imagine what we could do, you know, if the Buddhists combined their resources. So we actually did work together. So we visited each other's temples and stayed in each other's temples and enjoyed each other's company and sort of found out all the wonderful things we have in common and celebrated that. Because in our modern world, there are just too many people just arguing over the differences. Look how many different Christian sects there are. And even Muslim sects as well. And Jewish sects. Now, does that really inspire us in our modern world? That people of the same religion can't work together. Where is our hope? Because religion is supposed to sort of settle our differences. We get some harmony and peace in our world. So as Buddhists, I think that's one of the things we should do to move forward. Especially in a country like Malaysia. We've done it to a certain extent over in Australia. About 4 or 5 years ago, we started the Australian Sangha Association. For all the Buddhist monks and nuns of all the major traditions to come together to work together for our common cause of Buddhism in the land of Australia has been highly successful. So by coming together, we've made all these wonderful contacts between the monks and nuns of all the major traditions, and we're good friends. We work together on things like visas for monks and nuns, so we can say we all work together, and then we're very powerful. And other little issues which relate to monks and nuns or to Buddhism in general. So if you really want to do something to make Buddhism go further, join together and see if we can have more intra-faith dialogue, meetings, harmony, so we can truly work together. So all this separation is disappeared. If you ever find any monk, any nun, or any teacher saying, I'm the best, I'm the only true monk, well, I'm the only nun who knows what the Buddha really taught. All the rest of those monks and nuns are scallywags. They don't know what they're talking about. I'm the only one who's got the truth. That is a dead ringer. That's what we say in Australia. That's almost certain admission they don't know what they're talking about. It's just called pride. It's called conceit. So when we learn how to work together, what are we actually creating? We're creating harmony. And sometimes, look, if we two, three, can't work together, what right have we to sort of talk to a man or wife who are arguing, want to get separated, and tell them to work together when we can't even work together? We're just big hypocrites. So it's important that we learn how to work together. So intra-faith is something great we can do. And we can actually start doing that when we start actually reading and finding out, gee, we've got so much in common. Now, once we do the bit of study, one of the things you will learn if you look at what the Buddha was teaching, that one of the great practices we're supposed to be doing is just following our meditation. And that's something which was not done, actually it was done traditionally. But it's only like the last 30 or 40 years that people have really been focusing on that. And you know one of the reasons why? It's because all these scientists and professors over in the West have been doing all this research about meditation. And so much wonderful stuff is coming out now that it's become like a therapy. It's what doctors tell people to do. I get so many people coming to my centre because they are referred by their doctors. You go and learn some meditation. I don't know what it's like over in Malaysia, but most modern countries, one of the biggest problems in their government is the spiralling health budget. How much it costs to keep people healthy. And that's why meditation is so perfect. It don't cost anything. And it's so effective. We got a monastery over in California. They told me this. Or rather, I heard about it, but the last time I saw them, I checked it out. Is this really true? Because in a place like the United States, there's hardly any free medical care. You have to get insurance. And that health insurance costs a lot of money. I don't know what you have over here in Malaysia, whether it's free health or free. You're beautiful. It's a wonderful country. It's a sign of a great country when you look after the sick and the elderly. So that's what I think is a great country. But in the United States, you have to look after yourself. But if you, when you're filling out your health insurance in California, if you can get someone like me to actually to sign that yes, you meditate regularly, you get a huge reduction in the amount of money you have to pay for health insurance. You do. And the reason is because when you meditate, you're much healthier. Now it's okay to exercise and eat the right food and stuff, but the biggest cause of death is just worry, depression, anxiety, panic. The mind kills more people than the heart does. Be careful there. So, if you want to have a healthier body and a healthier life, let's meditate. Look, it's for free at the BGF. You don't even have to pay for it. If you go to the United States, you have to pay for meditation teachers and instructors. It's become an industry now. So, you can be ahead of the game. Or even better, if any of you have just lost your job because of the recession, come and learn some meditation and set yourself up as a mindfulness-based cognitive therapist. That's what it's called, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And it works, and you can heal so many people, you make a fortune. But remember, 10% goes to BGM. That people are actually doing that now. And there's so many invitations and opportunities. If you really want a nice little earner, as they say, learn meditation, learn how to become a teacher. You can go on these cruise ships. Because on cruise ships, you have a yoga teacher, you need a meditation teacher as well, so you can spend the rest of your life cruising to these exotic places. Just teaching a little bit of meditation once or twice a day to these rich people from the United States. And you have a wonderful life. See the opportunities which I'm giving you today. But at the very least, learn it for yourself. And teach it to your kids, for goodness sake. Because it has been proven. There was a professor over in Harvard who was following meditators. It was her PhD thesis. It was post-grad. And she found something amazing. She followed these meditators over 7 years. And obviously she was doing experiments with control group, people who didn't meditate at all. And she found that the people who meditated for 7 years had bigger brains. Their brains actually grew. Their cortex actually grew inside. No, this is no joke, that's true. If your kid is having a hard time doing his O-levels, It's because he hasn't got enough brain. How do you get more brain? Send him to the BTF. We'll increase his brain size by meditation. That's actually true. It works. So that's, well, even this last year in Western Australia, the top kid who graduates from the high schools, they win a medal called Beasley Medal. The winner of the Beasley Medal, I think 2008, was one of my disciples. Goes to our centre, learns meditation, and he's now got a scholarship to Harvard. For free. All expenses paid. That could be your kid. So send it to meditation. It's great. So that's one of the things we really should be doing. Now, a lot of people say, oh, this meditation is so hard. You've got to sit on your bum for hour after hour and it's so sore. Even just listening to a talk for an hour, it gets me sore. You don't need to sit on the floor. You can sit on a chair to meditate. Many people become enlightened sitting on chairs. You know what they design chairs for? To sit on. So you can meditate on a chair. So it's great. Well, can I still become enlightened? Am I just not doing second class meditation? No, you do first class meditation. We've been meditating on chairs over in the West for years and years now, and people get really good meditation. So that's great. You can sit on a chair to meditate. Wow. And it's so easy to do. It's just learning how to relax. Can you relax your body? Relax the mind. Just sit there and make peace, be kind, be gentle, and have one of the greatest gifts, peace of mind. That's what's on offer, and it's not that hard to do. And each one of you is more than able to get beautiful, delicious, oh, so nice, peace of mind. At least for a few moments, a few minutes, who knows, even longer. People actually do this. These are ordinary people. Just like you, actually you're not ordinary, you're extraordinary. Because people who come to the BGF, they're the A-list of Kuala Lumpur, the Klang Valley. So you're already way up there, elite. So you should have no problem at all about meditating. But the trouble is that people think meditation is so tough and so hard. That's why if you ever want to have a lovely time meditating, you come to sort of one of the sort of retreats which I do, or one of my disciples do. And it's those of you who've been to our retreat center, we built this retreat center, thanks also to the BTF, because many people here gave donations to our retreat center over in Perth. Every room has got its own ensuite. Think about that. And it's so peaceful and quiet. And you know what we mean by noble silence? Have you heard that before, in retreats, noble silence? You know what it means? It means we don't ring any bells. No bell silence. We don't have any bells. You know, it's not like going to prison. You know, you have to get up at a certain time and then you've got to do this at a certain time. It's not like being at school again. When we have no bell silence, I let people meditate whenever they want, however long they want. To get up when they need to get up, to go to bed when they want to go to bed. To give this beautiful sense of freedom and relaxation. No pressure on people. And that works so well. People actually meditate more that way. Why? Not because they have to. Because they want to. Because they enjoy it. I've been a monk for how many now? About 35, 36 years now. Because I enjoy my meditation. It's not something you do like go to a dentist. I've got to do my meditation because it hurts, but I don't want to do it, but I have to do it. No, you do it because you love doing it. It's the most wonderful thing to do. That is part, the central part of Buddhism. And when people do this, it's amazing the results. What was it just on my last retreat? Somebody sent me a letter. They took sort of a week off work. I think they were over in Sydney. Took a week off work, and they had to really argue with their boss. You know, demand it. You know, just not demand. Like always working. When they got to work, she sent me a letter and said, the boss said, I don't know what you were on in the last 7 days, but whatever it was, you've made me very happy. Keep on that drug or whatever it was you were taking the last week. I wasn't taking any drugs, I was just meditating. People see the results in you. Another case study. There was this man, years ago, he always wanted to go on a meditation retreat. And he'd ask his wife, darling, can I go on a retreat? Just a weekend. What do you mean going on a retreat? Don't you know you have to help me with the washing and the shopping? We've got to take our kids to the sports, to the violin lessons. We've got to clean out the gutters. There's so many jobs to do. Of course you can't just take the weekend off and be selfish husbands. You know what they're like. This is in Australia, remember. I think we get away with a lot here in Malaysia. You men. But anyway, so he said, okay, I'm not going. And so he waited for the next chance. Darling, there's a retreat on this weekend. Can I go? Oh, of course you can't go. Mother's coming around. We've got to prepare for this. We've got to do the garden. Of course you can't go. Okay. But he was persistent. Every time there was a retreat on, he'd ask to go. His wife would say no. But once, he said, there's a retreat on, darling. And she was just so fed up. She said, okay, you go and be selfish. You leave me with the kids and the housework and the washing and the shopping and everything else. Go on, you be selfish. So he went. But what happened next? When he came back home, he was such a wonderful husband. She could actually see the change in him. He was just so soft and gentle and cuddly and just, you know, just the sort of husband you'd like to have after meditation. And she was so impressed. Next time there was a retreat, he didn't even need to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. True story. Why is that happening? Because it actually changes you. Now remember, many people have to put up with you. All the people you work with have to put up with you. Your family has to put up with you. So out of compassion and kindness to all those have to endure you. Change your life. A bit of meditation. Soften yourself. Have a beautiful heart. Because that's what meditation does. And so actually, you're actually changing yourself in a really big way. You become beautiful people. Which is why one of the most popular things we do over in the West is we just meditate. And people actually come to the classes, they just want to meditate. Give them a talk, but they just want to meditate. The meditation really takes off. And you don't need to be young. You can be young or old. Sometimes little kids, 6, 7, or 8 years of age, they start to meditate, and their school really takes off. When they start doing things like that, they become confident, their learning improves, because this is training the mind. How many kids have attention deficit disorder? What does meditation do? It shows you how to pay attention. Not with force, but with gentleness. So your kids, they learn how to meditate, start to focus. Let alone kids. How many husbands have got attention deficit disorder? Not paying a word of attention to what you'd say. Or wives, whatever. So we actually become more attentive, more sensitive. It actually does a huge amount for us. We grow with this spiritual power. And that is one of the most amazing things, which one of the great advantages Buddhists have over all the other religions. We invented meditation. Now, we should have taken out the patent. We know what the Buddha's like, just, you know, free. So, but nevertheless, in PJ, BGF has got the franchise. So, well, where's your temple, is it PJ? Well, we share franchises, who cares? But whatever. what happens is that it's a great thing for us to do. So, one of the problems now, honestly, is there's not enough meditation teachers. So a lot of people want to meditate, but there's not enough people who can actually teach. So, opportunity for you. Yeah. So, you know, it's a waste of time. How often do you have to keep importing monks and nuns from overseas? You know, imports, it's bad for the economy, your trade deficit goes down. It's wonderful to sort of become self-sufficient. Now, it's hard getting monks and nuns to become ordained. I don't know why that is. That's a wonderful thing. We need more Malaysian Buddhist monks and nuns. Okay, so I think what we should actually do is just have a raffle. And whoever gets the lucky number gets to ordain. But no, we just really encourage that. Now, I remember saying this to the chief when he was still alive. He said, the trouble with Malaysia is that every parent is just so happy and inspired when somebody else's son becomes a monk, but not their son. Well, it's wonderful your son's becoming a monk, but your son, no. Oh, your daughter. We need more. But, to be realistic, it's not going to happen soon. But what can happen is we can have lay people sort of teaching meditation, as we've already got. But we need more of them. So you get in there, learn your meditation, and start spreading it around. It works so well, and quite frankly, you can make a nice little part-time job out of it. Listen, this is no joke. Corporations, schools, this is going to be a growing opportunity. Because everybody knows in the West, all universities, the research has been done, it works. It's beneficial in treating cancers, depressions, in schools, in prisons, in corporations. Now, like in Australia, like in Europe, like in the United States, competition is getting harder and harder. If you want to keep your competitive edge, you need something to become more efficient with less stress. Meditation is the way. I don't know how many corporations say, come teach us meditation, come teach us meditation. It works. So that's opportunities for you. So, then we teach meditation. It's also teaching meditation to others. It's a great way, again, of spreading into faith, a harmony. Because this is one of our great strengths. Other religions have got other strengths. Like, for example, one of the great strengths of Christianity, their charity has been just so strong, especially internationally. Now, the Buddhists are catching up. Muslims are catching up as well, but it seems to be anyway, as far as the media is concerned, Christians, you know, with all their aid agencies, they usually got the edge there. But what is the strength of Buddhists? Now, we've got all this skill, all this understanding, historical resources of meditation. That's something we can give to this world. To teach it throughout our whole communities for the happiness and the benefit and peace of all people. Learn it oneself. Teach it well. I don't mean to be enlightened, just to be able to teach people how to relax. But not only that, because once one learns how to relax, one opens up this whole treasure chest of wisdom. One of the great things, other things about Buddhism, is just the insight, the wisdom which comes out of just looking inside your own heart and finding out how you work, finding out who you are, and learning to accept yourself and accept others. It's amazing just how wise people become when they stop thinking. When they just listen and see rather than just try to think about things. And that type of wisdom, whether that is new ideas for your company, new sort of avenues for your research and development projects in science. Whatever it is, it actually works. You get more ideas, you're fresh, you're open. That's actually where I get all my ideas from, to innovate just by making my mind really still and peaceful. There was a person who rang up a monk, and they asked him, said, "Can you come to my house to do some ceremony?" He said, "No, no, I'm busy." "So what are you doing?" He said, "I'm doing nothing." He said, "I'm busy. That's what monks are supposed to do." So, yeah, you can accept that, because that's what monks are supposed to do. "No, I'm supposed to do nothing, be peaceful." Okay, so he rang the next day. He said, "No, I rang you yesterday, can you come and do some chanting? But, you know, you were busy, you know, you're nothing business. Can you come today?" He said, "No, I'm busy again." "What are you doing?" "Nothing," he said. "That's what you said yesterday." "Yes," said the monk, "I'm not finished yet." So get your nothing out of the way, first of all. Get your relaxation and your peace out of the way. And then do the other things. So prioritize. You get this wonderful wisdom. What's most important in life? Is it really being the richest person in the cemetery? Is that what you try to achieve? No, it's being the happiest person, a peaceful person. So the meditation opens up insights. And when you open up insights, now the last thing is quite controversial, but this comes from a friend who was, he was the premier, the head politician in the state of Western Australia, who I got to know very well. He came along because he was a very successful politician. He was also the best man at Tony Blair's wedding, a very close friend of Tony and Sherry Blair, the former British Prime Minister. So he knows politics in and out. And once he started getting to know Buddhism, he said, "You Buddhists are hiding something from us all. You have these amazing resources, your wisdom, your meditation, your spiritual resources. Can't you please help us politicians?" And he was serious about it. You get the Copenhagen climate change talks ending in utter failure because people don't know how to listen to each other and work together. That's something which Buddhism can actually help with. Sometimes that people just have old ideas and they can't innovate. That's something which a peaceful mind trained in meditation can really help with. When this politician started listening and discovering what we Buddhists know, he challenged me. He said, "You should really get some of these ideas more into the political arena. Because our planet, our world, is in a very, very fragile state. Whether it's credit crunch, recessions, wars, terrorism, all the problems which face our world, which are real. What is Buddhism doing to help?" We can do a lot. I'm not saying start a Buddhist party, political party. I'm saying just whatever political party you're in or you get involved in, start feeding in some Buddhist principles, some Buddhist ideas. Just compassion, forgiveness, letting go. Just, you know, realizing just the interconnectedness of everything. Gee, some of these ideas of Buddhism are just so powerful and so strong. I think it's part of our job to actually try and push some of those things into our political arena. Because our children and our children's children depend upon it. So, it's quite a challenge, but we're open to it. Why not? We've come a long way. You know, I've been coming to Malaysia a long time. How many years have I come into Malaysia? But I've seen Buddhism in Malaysia grow and prosper, see it in Singapore grow and prosper, certainly in Australia and other countries. It's growing. It's pushing it along a bit further and see what happens. To take it beyond just pujas, chanting and charity and just listen to Dharma talks. Let's do something. Thank you for listening. Okay, we'll do the sharing of merits now. With all your deceased relations, which deceased in the last 49 days, and others, please recite with me, Idam Me.
Idam Me Yati Nang Hotu Sukhita Hontu Yatayo. Idam Me Yati Nang Hotu Sukhita Hontu Yatayo. Idam Me Yati Nang Hotu Sukhita Hontu Yatayo. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu. Yeah, good idea.